the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong. Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday, presented by Bullet Train. Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, standing at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky. It is time to get on board the Bullet Train. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Della Pina, back with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Welcome back to everybody who has been with us on XM 209 for the past 3 hours with our coverage of Gulfstream and Tampa Bay Downs. And of course, a very special welcome to everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93 and of course on Internet Smartphone Channel 961. And JT, what an edition of Trainer Talk we have forthcoming this evening. These have become some of our favorite shows to do because we get to visit with so many of the top names in the game and talk to them about their lives and their backgrounds and how they got started. And we've heard so many tremendous stories that really make this sport what it is.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about racing. Everybody in the game has a story, and they're unique and they're fascinating. I love listening to these trainers talk about their lives, how they got started, what turns them on about the game. And it's a whole new look. And for many people, it's putting a personality with that name that they see in the program or the racing form. They see the names, but they don't really know the person. And it gives the fans an opportunity to learn more about their life and what makes them tick.
Jimmy Jerkins is going to be here with us for the first half hour, right up until 6:30 Eastern time. And then Barkley Tagg will join us for the second half of the show. So a lot to look forward to. Let's get to it. Jimmy with us now, the 54-year-old native of Bayshore, New York, and somebody who has a pedigree that always suggested he would be a successful trainer. He's the son of Hall of Fame trainer H. Allen Jerkins, and he's with us now. Jimmy, thanks so much for taking the time tonight.
Thank you.
Jimmy, you look at your resume. I mentioned being a son of H. Allen Jerkins, but you look at your resume, 608 winners, including a pair of Breeders' Cup winners with Artie Schiller, Corinthian. You had Quality Road. You've had so many nice horses in your care. You've done a pretty nice job and made a good name for yourself.
Yeah, things started out good for me right from the start. You know, I started pretty late on my own. I was my dad's assistant for 20 years. Since graduating high school in 1977, and I just went on my own in the fall of 1997, and was lucky enough to get, I didn't get a lot of horses, but I had some pretty good horses for Mrs. DuPont and Earl Mack, and Peter Blum also helped out a lot. So I was lucky enough to start out on the right foot and get some good winners right away, and it started to build up from there.
Well, let's go back a little bit further than that. What's it like growing up with your dad being Allen Jerkins?
Well, it was something all of us were enormously proud of, no doubt about that. I mean, as far back as I can remember, we still lived in Laurelton, Queens in the mid-60s. And I don't know if anybody else remembers, there used to be a show Win Elliott would host. I believe it was on Channel 9 or 11. I can't remember, but it was on every Saturday. It came on at 4 o'clock, and they would show the co-feature and the stake. Co-feature was the sixth race, and the stake race was the seventh race in those days in New York. And it seemed like every week we were tuning in to watch whether he had a horse in the co-feature and the feature, or almost always in the co-feature at least, and a lot of times in the feature. And you know, it was just thrilling. You know, always had those good old hard knocking horses running in the co-feature, and they'd be win or second, and then naturally the stakes were running against Buck Passer. One time we saw him upset a Buck Passer with Handsome Boy in the Brooklyn Handicap. That was 1967. I'll never forget that as long as I live. Watching that in the den of our house in Huntington, and you know, and then I started going to the barns on the weekends when I got old enough to work around the horses, which was pretty young, I guess around 9 or 10, and then worked all the weekends and all the vacations during school, and then and all summer in Saratoga, and then graduating high school, I worked full time.
A lot of trainers' kids get into the business, but there's the other half that run away from it because they see how hard their dads work and they're gone all the time and they don't want anything to do with it. And that's kind of been a common theme as we do these shows is the split. Some trainers' kids love the game and some of them would just as soon do something else. But what was it that really got you hooked to getting in and working with your dad?
I don't know if it was something that I really, I just held him in such high esteem, admired him so much. I just wanted to be as much like him as I could. That was pretty much what pushed me along. I mean, I liked the horses enough for sure, but you know, it was just one of those hero worship things. I just wanted to be just like him, you know, because I saw how well respected he was. Found that out from an early age, not only because of his great success, but just how admired he was by everybody because of how helpful he was to everybody around him. And, you know, I just wanted to be just like him. And I got, you know, I got real serious about it pretty early. You know, I knew that's what I wanted to do. Even when I was in high school, and I knew I wasn't going to go to college. I don't even think I took the SATs or anything like that. I knew I was going to go right to the track. So, That's pretty much what pushed me on.
Did your dad encourage you to follow in his footsteps and become a trainer, Jimmy?
I don't know if he encouraged me, but he didn't discourage me either. You know, he didn't. I can't ever remember him sitting me down or ever saying, "Don't you think you want to go to? You know, don't you think you want to go to college and do? You know, do be a have a normal life?" You know, never heard him ever say anything like that. I think every father would you know likes if their kids would go on and do what they do. You know, I think they really certainly get a satisfaction out of that. So my older brother Alan, he liked the horses, but he was a sports nut. He loves baseball, and he kind of drifted away from the track and went to college and became a sportscaster. But he's still very knowledgeable about the game. And, of course, my brother Steven's a trainer also.
Is your brother still a sportscaster today?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. In Tulsa, Oklahoma. Yeah.
Doing baseball?
Well, he does everything. He covers the college basketball and he's on the sports night, news sports nightly.
Oh, wow.
And just those various things out there.
Well, I think you're right about fathers wanting their kids to emulate them. And, of course, your dad, as you mentioned, is so helpful to everybody. When I was training horses, I was introduced to him by Richard Mandela, and I shipped into his barn at Gulfstream for the Orchid Handicap, and he couldn't have been any nicer to me. He treated me so well, and anything that I needed, he was there for. And he just has that reputation around the track, and everybody looks up to him, and so it's easy to see why you would want to emulate that. And from what I hear, you've done a pretty good job of that.
Yeah, I mean, the last year or two have been a little slow for us compared to what we've done up till then. Just haven't had the same stock we had other years. I had Quality Road and Artie Schiller, but you know, it'll pick up again, I'm sure.
Jimmy, you mentioned working with your dad for 20 years as his assistant before you went out on your own. You were able to share so many of those memorable moments with your dad that had to be very special. What are some of the moments that really stand out to you with those 20 years of working with him?
Well, going all around the country with Devil Is Due probably was, around that years he was running, they had that concept, the championship series where you bounced all around the country to get handicap points. I think Barry Weisbord came up with that idea, and they had it for a few years, and I thought it was terrific. And that was all getting on the van with him and going all over. We even took the van all the way to Arkansas from Belmont. I'll never forget that. It was just me and the horse and the whole van from one end to the other. and going down there to Oaklawn, first time I was ever in Oaklawn. First time I remember seeing Bobby Baffert, he had some horses there running in the stakes and meeting everybody. And then, of course, Sky Beauty, you know, she was terrific. Just, you know, we were monitoring her every step she took, you know, and it was very stressful, but at the same time, very rewarding, because I think she won about eight or nine grade ones and carried a big and very big info. I never hear anybody talk about that. She carried 130 or 132 pounds when she won the Hempstead Handicap one year, beat a real nice filly of Mac Miller's called You'd Be Surprised. Must have gave her at least 12 or 13 pounds. But, you know, she goes down as one of the very best of all time, but it doesn't seem like she gets much recognition.
Well, you know, it's funny. I can remember as a kid growing up in Western Massachusetts, Pittsfield is where I grew up, Jimmy, and I cut my teeth on racing at Saratoga, and so I grew up following Sky Beauty and Devil Is Due, and I would take a camera to Saratoga, and I still have photo albums of those two horses at my house where I would just take pictures of them in the post parade, and I became a fan of this sport really in large part because of those two horses.
Yeah, well, see, they were hard knocking horses, especially Devil Is Due. I mean, I think he won just under $4 million, and he ran a bunch of times, and he danced every dance. And you know, it doesn't seem like you see those kind around anymore. People are much more selective about running their horses now than they were. I sound like I'm talking about like 50 years ago, but it was only 20 years ago, not even. But that really, the game has changed a lot in even that short time. So, yeah, they were special horses, no doubt. And Missy's Mirage also was just almost as good as both of them. She gave us a lot of thrills.
When you were working with your dad, what were some of the specific things that you took away from him when you went out on your own?
Just basically, you know, attention to detail and just observing a lot. You know, just so many horses can tell you so much. Just you go by the quiet time at night and go by, and you can see little things that they do in the stall, which really can clue you in as how they're doing, you know, good or bad. And, you know, just little things like that. And I can, you know, it always put it to good use. And it's you can never spend too much time at the barn, I don't think.
Jimmy, how difficult was it to make that decision to break away from your dad, all the success that you guys had together, and then go out on your own? Was it a difficult decision, or was it something that was pretty easy for you?
Well, it was kind of strange the way it happened. I just had gone through a divorce, and I was feeling kind of down about everything. And he kind of was, you know, kind of sensed it a little bit. And he said to me, "Do you think if he was training?" He had quite a few horses at the time for Peter Blum, who's still pretty active in the game, especially in the breeding side of it. We had about a half a dozen horses of his at the time that really weren't, you know, weren't really doing very well. We weren't having good luck at the time. And he said, you think if I called Peter up and asked him to give you these horses and start you out, and he agreed to it, would you be interested? I said, sure. You know, he said, you could probably do it for cheaper, cheaper per diem, you know, to do some of the work yourself. And I was friendly with Peter besides that. We had known each other for a long time before that. And that's how it started. I got about six horses for Peter Blum and Mrs. DuPont, like I said. I got two or three from her. And Earl Mack was a big help also. He gave me a couple of useful horses right from the start. And then I moved right across the street from my father's barn at Belmont. It's in the barn that Pletcher's in now at Belmont. It's facing one of the big round barns at Belmont. And that's where I started. And we did very good the first year. And it just basically, we built up, not by leaps and bounds, but we built up gradual every year and did a little better every year. And then the Moores, Susan and John Moore, got into the game pretty big. And we had a lot of luck together. And then an Artie Schiller came along, and then Mr. Evans sent me a few horses and sent me Quality Road in the middle of August. They didn't think much of him at all because he was just a big gangly looking, skinny looking horse that they had down there in South Carolina, was slow to come around, and sent up to me in the middle of August, and we just started training him, and it's unbelievable. After about 3 weeks, he just started to turn around and become professional about everything, and he got to the races in 3 months from that day on, and he won by about 7 lengths and ran 6.5 and 16 flat. So, you know, he certainly showed he was something special from that day on, that's for sure.
Yeah, as a racing fan, Jimmy, I feel like we kind of got robbed with Quality Road. I don't think we ever found out how good that horse really was. How good was he?
He was by far the best horse, talent-wise, I ever had, no question. I mean, he could do things just take your breath away. What he did in Florida that year as a 3-year-old was just, I mean, we went down there. He'd only run the one time, and he got beat by a horse of Kenny McPeak's. I can't remember the name of him right now that he had no business getting beat by. But he didn't do very well when we first went down there. He didn't look like I'd like him to look. He wasn't carrying the kind of flesh you want a horse to look when they're just turning 3. And Mr. Evans was all... I ended up watching the race with him, which wasn't a lot of fun. And he got beat, and he was all down and out. And, you know, I said, I don't think he's right, Mr. Evans. I think we just put him away, we give him a little break, and crank him back up. I still think we really got a good horse here. And, you know, I'll not forget that day. It took a long time to cool him out. He wasn't really receptive to how he ran. So he was a tough man. He was very tough on me for some reason. But well, he ended up taking the horse away too after he had won a Grade One. So but I don't know. He never really took to me for some reason. But and then we trained him up to the we trained him up to the Fountain of Youth, and he just ran sensational. And had some spectacular works leading up to the Florida Derby, and he won that also. But I mean, he just did things. He could do things you just never see. He just had that freaky talent, and he had a great disposition to start with. He was one of those horses that just wanted to please, and he was just an absolute delight to train.
It's always great to have those kind of horses. You mentioned being around the barn all the time, and I think that's a hallmark that your dad has too. He makes more wardrobe changes than a Las Vegas showgirl sometimes. I was always amazed. You know, he'll go to school one, he'll put his sport coat on, he'll come back, he'll take that off, he'll put on his swim trunks, hose yeah. down the area around the barn, then he'll go back, run a horse, come back, and then he'll put on some sweatpants or something to play football with the barn help. I mean, the guy's amazing. How he spends almost all day at the barn. You don't see trainers, you know, of his caliber doing it. I know you do the same exact thing. I mean, maybe not the wardrobe changes, but you're a hands-on guy, and that's so rare in our business these days.
Yeah, well, you know, because a lot of people are having such tremendous success just being the business side, and that's probably, you know, where I probably need to get a little better at is, you know, you got to cultivate, you know, the old owners are going and the new ones are coming up, and they don't know you from a hole in the ground. You got to, you know, it's time to get out to, you got to go to all the sales now, and you got to cultivate the new owners. Else, you know, you're going to fall behind. No question about it.
Jimmy, how often do you talk with your dad about horses and maybe some of the horses you have in training?
Well, pretty often. I don't know, but we talk so much about our horses, really, back and forth. We just, you know, when they run, like he'll say, like he'll look at the paper and see I have a horse in, and then, you know, find out the result, and if it didn't run very well, he'd ask my opinion of what do you think, why do you think, and all that kind of stuff. But then every once in a while he'll if he has a strong feeling about, you know, something I might be missing, he'll definitely let me know.
Is there any kind of fun rivalry between you and your brother up there in New York? I know I like to needle my brother a little bit.
No, not really. It's such a tough business. We just root for everybody to have any kind of success we can have. Naturally, if you're running against each other, you're not going to want to get beat by him. Let's face it. We're not all that nice of guys. We're all in the same boat and just got to root each other on.
Yeah, I think that's a hallmark of old school trainers is that, they realize how hard it is to be successful in this game, and they appreciate when they win, and they like to see their friends or their relatives do well, and you don't see that a lot anymore either. You see a lot of guys that are kind of cutthroat, and they're always hustling around trying to steal your customers and all that stuff. Yeah. So it's a tough racket.
Yeah, it's gotten tough. I mean, it seems like, you just see there's an awful lot of greed in the game now. I mean, it's for some people, it just seems like it's never enough. It's one thing I can say about my dad is, he's just as fierce a competitor as there ever was. But, I can never, ever see him ever take any food out of anybody's mouth in the process. So, I mean, that's the greatest thing about him.
Jimmy Jerkins, our special guest tonight on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jimmy, what comes to mind when I mention September 28th, 1997, and I mention the name Ninth Inning?
Yeah, that was my first winner. Yep. She, Peter Blum owned her and bred her. And I think Robbie Davis rode her, if I remember correctly. But she ended up winning three in a row. She won that day, and she won a Aether then, and then she won a stake called the Astorita, I believe. I don't think they run it anymore.
But, yeah.
That was a big thrill. She got me going.
One of the races that you won that I'll never forget is your Breeders' Cup with Corinthian. It was just pouring down rain that day Monmouth, and I had been doing paddock interviews all day. I was so soaked. I mean, my shoes were full of water and everything else. But I watched that race, and it was such a pleasure to watch that horse run. He's such a beautiful horse, and you'd done such a fine job with him. Talk about him a little bit.
Well, he was a pulpit. He was a fiery horse who would get upset at the slightest little thing. He really needed some coddling when he was a 2-year-old, especially. We first ran him in a sprint race going 6 furlongs, and Jose Santos rode him. And I told him, I said, I don't want you to hit this horse. Maybe hit him once or twice. That's all. I said, I don't want him to have a hard race because, he just wasn't mature. I didn't want anything to make him any more nervous than he already was. I want him to have as good of experience starting out as we possibly could. I said, if you can win it, of course, we'll want you to win it, but I don't want you to beat him to death. And he rode him absolutely perfect. He broke a little slow, and he let him get hit with a little dirt, and he pulled him out. He pulled him out at the head of the stretch, and he hit him, just smacked him once or twice. And he finished second to a horse of my father's called St. Damon, who ended up I think my brother had him, in later years. Matter of fact, I think last year was his last year. He ran till last year. He was still running. And I was just thrilled to death about how, I said, well, we can only just move forward from here. When you get your horse finishes second and flying at the end, just what you're looking for in the first time out. So I go to stand him in the starting gate about 2 weeks later. I always do that with all my horses before they run, just to get their reaction to the gate, Not going to break out of it, but just standing back out. And he went berserk in the gate, and I just couldn't believe it. I thought we did everything right with this horse, and he's going to lose his mind. And it took us a long time to get him over the gate issue. And we didn't run him again. I don't think we ran him again until real late in the year, going a mile right before we went to Florida, and he won easily. Then we went down to Florida, and his first start as a 3-year-old was disastrous. It was opening day at Gulfstream in a race called the Aventura. That was bad thing for a race of his to be opening day. We didn't have a chance to ship him over there and school him or anything like that, and it was a disaster. He went crazy in the gate, and he got scratched at the gate. So that was a disaster. But then we regrouped again and got him going, got his head screwed on right, and ran him in an allowance race, and he won easy, going a mile and an eighth. And then we ran him in the Fountain of Youth, and he won but got disqualified. He veered out bad into First Samurai and got DQ'd. Then I believe we shipped him back home here to get ready for the Wood, and he got a thing called, in his hind past, and he got a fracture called, they call it a meat cleaver fracture. Doesn't require any surgery, but it is a fracture, and you just got to stop him until it heals. And I believe he went from there to Saratoga. Ran once in Saratoga and was a bad third in allowance race, but he had broke out in a horrible skin rash. So we just gave him the whole rest of the year. Sent him home to Middleburg from Saratoga and gave him the rest of the year off and brought him back to Gulfstream the next year. And then he had a terrific year as a four-year-old. He won the Gulfstream Park Handicap. He won the Met, and then he won the Breeders' Cup.
Jimmy Jerkins, our special guest here tonight on Trainer Talk. Jimmy, just about 2 minutes left here in the show, and it's flown by. We could have spent another hour with you easily. We haven't even talked about Artie Schiller yet. That was a phenomenal race as well in the Breeders' Cup and a tremendous experience, I'm sure.
Yes, it was. You know, every once in a while, everything goes right, and everything went picture perfect leading up to the race. He just trained. He ran in the Kelso a month before that, got beat ahead. Poor horse of Grand Motions. Poor horse ended up breaking down in the Breeders' Cup, his next start. His name escapes me right now. But Garrett Gomez gave him a gorgeous ride. I can't see why we didn't win the Eclipse Award. I mean, he beat the only meeting they had together. He beat Leonardo's Amino as fair and square as you can. And I don't know. I just don't know why he didn't win the Eclipse Award. Just wasn't meant to be.
Well, Jimmy, one final question before we let you go. Where were you the day that Onion beat Secretariat?
I was on the backstretch, right where that stand is. If you guys are know Saratoga, the backstretch is a stand called it's called the Morning Line now. It used to be a much smaller stand. It was just a little fruit stand in those days. And I remember the old people that had the stand, had a TV. They had a TV hookup somehow out there, and I remember watching some of it when they first came out of the gate on the TV, and then running to the rail and watched them going down the backstretch, and then go back to the TV, and then he ran back to the rail when they turned for home, and I saw him in front of Secretariat when they disappeared behind the tote board, and then I'm just saying to myself, well. I know when they emerge from the other side of the tote board, which is very close to the wire, you know, Secretary is going to be in front. And lo and behold, they came out of the other end of that tote board, and the orange silks were still in front. I just couldn't believe it. And they stayed that way to the wire, about three-quarters of a length in front.
Jimmy Jerkins, ladies and gentlemen. Jimmy, been so much fun. We do have to get to that break. Really appreciate you being here tonight. Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Thank you. It was great.
Great stuff. Thanks, Jimmy Jerkins. Wow. Amazing stuff.
Great story.
Barkley Tag is up next. We're back with more here on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
You're listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train on HRRN. Bullet Train. It's time to get on board.
Group-winning Bullet Train, the sensational three-quarter brother to the amazing racehorse Frankel, has captured the hearts and dreams of everyone who's seen him. Handsome and correct, he was precocious enough to win his debut at two with a massive 113 time form rating. Bullet Train had the speed American breeders seek and the class to defeat 11 horses who won or placed in a Group 1. And his pedigree, well, being bred by Judmont Farm, says it all. This year, Bullet Train joins Montjoux and Galileo as top sons of Sadler's Wells at stud. He stands at Wintergreen Stallion Station in Midway, Kentucky, for a $7,500 stud fee. For more information, call Sean Feld at 859-519-9665. Bullet Train has arrived at the station. It's time to get on board.
HRRN is your exclusive radio home for the 2013 Kentucky Derby. Join our Eclipse Award-winning broadcast team as we take you along the road to the Kentucky Derby with live coverage of every major Derby prep race. And tune in Derby Week for over 20 hours of coverage live from Churchill Downs. Go to horseracingradio.net for a full schedule of races. It's the 139th Run for the Roses, only on HRRN.
Hi, this is Calvin Burrow. You're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is our Wednesday night feature. You can catch the show every single Wednesday night. If you missed any of our previous Trainer Talk shows, a podcast available on our website, horseracingradio.net. An outstanding visit with Jimmy Jerkins in the first half of the show. And now really looking forward to our next special guest here in the second half. That's trainer Barkley Tagg, the native of Abington, Pennsylvania. He's trained more than 1,400 winners for his career, actually closing in on 1,500. And one of those, a Kentucky Derby and Preakness winner, that's Funnyside. And Barkley, nice enough to spend some time with us here tonight. Barkley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Happy to have you with us. And an amazing run, my friend, 1,472 winners. You didn't start with thoroughbreds, though. Your interest in horses goes back well beyond that. Talk about it.
Well, I was just a bored kid when I was younger, and I went to the local riding stable and took a few lessons, and then I couldn't afford them anymore, so the guy gave me a job to help him out on my afternoons off and my weekends and things like that, and I did that until I went off to college. I did a lot of showing in between there. After I learned to ride, I got to show for some people in the area around there and things like that, so I had some show horse experience. And then I went off to college, and I didn't even see a horse for about 4 or 5 years. And then I got a job managing a farm when I got out of college, and they had all kinds of horses there. They had race horses and steeplechase horses and fox hunters and things like that. So I got back into it pretty heavily then and got interested in steeplechasing, which I did a little bit of after the farm job. And then I decided I wanted to be a trainer, and I started that out all wrong.
But you finished it up good.
Well, I'd like to have done a lot better, but still, we've compiled a pretty good record, I think, for doing it the way we did it. I just, I did take a job. Actually, I started out at Pimlico with one horse, a rope shank, and a borrowed trailer to take it down there, and kind of gypped around a little bit for a while and galloped horses and trained that little horse, and she won a couple of races and did all right. And then I picked up another one from a wonderful doctor in Baltimore who was just a terrific friend for the next 40 years. He was just a wonderful, wonderful man, and I trained horses on and off for him for probably 20 years anyway, and he kind of held things together for me and helped me have a few horses to go with all the time, and I just gypped around. I just, like I say, I started out wrong. I didn't really go to work for somebody like Wayne Lucas for 10 years or anything like that, which would have been the smart way to do it, and I did go to work for Frank Whiteley 1 year when I'd kind of run out of horses, and I liked Frank a lot, and I really enjoyed the job. But I just wanted to get back on my own. I was just hard-headed about that kind of thing and wanted to work for myself. So I went back and struggled till about 79 or 80 before I started to get a few horses that were, a few stakes caliber horses and things like that. And then things started to pick up, and I finally bought a nice horse rather cheaply for some new people. And his name was Ruart in the mid-80s, and he won some races there a couple of stakes for me and things like that. And then he got hurt. It took me about 7 months to get him better. And then I was beaten by a horse there in the first race. I ran him back, and I was beaten about a nose by a horse called Little Bold John, I think it was. And he was one of the better horses in Maryland at the time, maybe the best horse in Maryland at the time. And then the people took him away and gave him to Wayne Lucas. And he went on and became a pretty nice horse, but I only paid $15,000 for him, so I was pretty happy that he became such a good horse in that way, but the rest of it was kind of a kick in the stomach. But he got me started, though. He got me stalls. He got me in favor with the racing secretary finally after 15 years of beating my head against the wall. And that helped a lot. And then I started to pick up more and more horses. And, I thought we did pretty good for a while there. And in the late 80s, we had quite a few stakes horses. And some of them did quite well. So we were happy with that. And finally, I decided I wanted to try New York. And I did that and started all over again, just begging for stalls and begging for horses and scuffling and scuffling and scuffling. But it worked out. I had some wonderful people that came to me in the mid-'80s, Tom and Bonner Young, and I've had horses for them ever since, still do, and they've supplied me with some very nice horses. They weren't big breeders, but they always had a few, and they were always very nicely bred and very nice horses.
Trainer Bart, one of their
horses won my first Grade One. We shipped a filly named Miss Josh out to California for the Gamely Handicap, and she won that. And that was my first Grade One. And my second Grade One was for the same people with a horse called Royal Mountain Inn, who won the Man of War at Belmont Park. So those people have been behind me all the way and have been wonderful, wonderful people. And then, we got more horses, and Funny Side came along and really set things on fire for us in the early 2000s. And, he won 9 stakes races. He had one thing I was proud of. He had 11 triple digit buyers in a row. And I've never seen that on another horse where they were actually in print and had 11 triple digit buyers in a row.
Wow.
So I thought that was interesting anyway.
Yeah, that's quite an accomplishment. He was a really good horse. He supplied me with one of my best weekends ever as a horse player, I can tell you that much.
That's great.
Barkley, do you remember the first time that you set eyes on Funny Side?
Yeah, I saw him probably early December. He was at I have a friend named Tony Everard, who's a popular conditioner in Ocala, Florida. He breaks babies and sends them to the races when they're ready, and he does a wonderful job. And he had him there. He had bought him himself for like $22,000, I think. And he had a good eye for a horse, but he had to. He always, did it in an economic way and bought horses that weren't really expensive, and did a great job with them. A lot of them turned out for a lot of people and ran very well. But I had passed over Funny at the sale. I don't remember exactly why. But he was just a real skinny, narrow horse at the sale. And for some reason, he was in the little New York bred sale that was kind of off campus there. And I don't know what it was, but I didn't buy him anyway. But Tony did. And I liked him when I saw him there at Tony's in December. And just kept an eye on him. I got to see him again first of January. I'd go up there about once a month and look at the horses, and I always had a couple of getting broken by him and stuff like that, so I'd make my trips up there once a month. And I liked this horse a little better every time I saw him. He got bigger and stronger and tougher, and I asked him how much he wanted for him. He wanted $40,000 for him first of January, and the first of February he wanted $60,000 for him, and first of March he wanted $75,000 for him. And I'd seen a lot of other bloodstock agents and friends of mine that were trainers and stuff that would show up there now and then when I was there, and they were all kind of looking at him, and nobody got him bought yet. So I told Jack Knowlton about him, and the funny thing was I'd had a little horse that I'd bought cheap from one owner and sold it to Jack Knowlton for the same price, and just to keep him and his people having a good time. They needed another horse to run at the time, and they wanted some action. It was just a cheap filly, and we ended up losing her in a claiming race for about twice what we paid for her, and that gave us enough money to buy Funny Side. So I talked them into buying Funny Side, and the rest is kind of history. It just worked out really good. That one little filly came along and made a good sale for them and kept everybody happy and gave them enough money to buy this horse. So now and then something turned out good for me, but it was few and far between a lot of times there.
Well, that's what happens in this game. A little bit of luck with one horse, you can parlay that into the next one. And, of course, in your case, it was legendary what happened, but just a fantastic set of circumstances. So it's interesting that you'd kept your eye on this horse. Now he gets into your care, and you know, what's your impression of Funnyside once he came into the Barkley Tag Shed, Ro?
Well, we had him at Belmont for a little while, and then we took him to Saratoga, and I had a little Irish girl, a little tiny Irish girl working for me. She was a great little rider, but she was so tiny that, you know, she seemed to get along with him fine. She'd gallop him out there, and one day he just ran off with her, and I clocked him at the last 3/8 I could get him, and he went in 36 flat. And I thought, I better get somebody up here that can handle this horse. And my girlfriend, Robin Smullen, was running a division for me in Delaware at the time. And I said, you better put that in somebody else's hands and come on up here. So she started riding him. She rode him every day from then on and did everything on him. And I don't think we'd have made it without her. She just took him over and rode him every workout and every gallop and everything for the next few years. And we took him to Palm Meadows for the winter. And Palm Meadows has that wonderful, like an extra track on the outside. We call it the L. It's an L-shaped track that goes about a mile out and a mile back. And horses seem to relax better out there and gallop on that. So we trained him out there quite a bit. And then we could just, you know, just let him gallop in behind the gate there and go ahead and do his workouts on the track. And it kind of worked out good. We had to keep him fooled a bit, but it kind of worked out really good. And, you know, he won a couple of classic races and went on. He ended up winning, I think he won 11 races and 9 of them were stakes. And I think he won a stake as a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old also. So that was, I don't think any other Kentucky Derby winner has ever done that, but that's probably because they go to stud too, and he couldn't do that. He was a gelding. So.
Yeah, well, and bringing up the gelding thing, Tom Durkin, the NBC announcer at the time, had referred to him as the gutsy gelding, and I thought it was very appropriate.
That.
A great description.
I remember that.
Yeah, did you see that quality in him in the early stages, Barkley?
You know, he was kind of built like a knife blade. He had a great hind end on him, but everything came to a point up front. And, you know, I always felt that he was a mile and a quarter horse, and I got so much flack training him about having Derby fever you know, I don't think the men that owned him were great, great bunch of guys, but I don't think they had a whole lot of faith in him being a mile and a quarter horse either. And they tried to get me to run him in some 7-furlong races as a 2-year-old after he won his first 3 races. And I wanted to freshen him up then and then put him on the Derby trail. And I finally talked him into that. And then he lost his first 3 Derby preps. He lost. But he did have 2 seconds and a fifth. He had a fifth in the first one. He was second in the next two. And then he went on, and I thought he won the Derby in a rather big way, and he won the Preakness in a huge way. So we had some trouble getting up to the Belmont Stakes, and then we had a horrible, rainy, muddy day that day, so he didn't do as well there, but he was still third. And as disappointed as I was, I couldn't hate him. <You know>? He ran a hell of a race.
What do you remember about that Derby experience, Barkley?
That was something else, I'll tell you. I mean, I don't think I'd ever even been to the Derby to watch it. And I remember when I was in the Army down at Fort Knox, years and years and years before, they gave us passes to go up and see the Derby. And I went over to Keeneland and went around and did kind of a farm tour and stuff like that day and hitchhiked back to Fort Knox. I didn't even go to – I wasn't going to go in there and fight all that mob. But I thought I would go if I ever had a horse that was capable of it. But other than that, I didn't really want to go.
I wonder what the person thought that picked you up when you were hitchhiking. They had no idea that you were a future Kentucky Derby winning trainer.
Neither did I.
Yeah, you know, this is my father was in World War II, way before your time. But my father did the exact same thing. He was stationed at Fort Knox, and this wealthy lady that he thinks might have been a horse owner picked him up. Him and his friend were hitchhiking from Fort Knox to go to the Derby. The first horse race my father ever went to was the Kentucky Derby. Talk about starting at the top.
Yeah,
and he bet on the California horse because he was a Californian. And I think the California horse ran fourth, but that's incredible that you had the same exact experience.
Well, I remember when I was a little kid in the riding stable, I'd sit there and I'd read these magazines when we'd have a lunch break. You know, we'd be in there eating soup on a cold day, and I'd read that they had a magazine back in those days called the Turf and Sport Digest. It had some glossy pictures in it and things like that. I'd look at that and I'd see, you know, Ben Jones and the Derby horses and all that. But it was so far removed from anything that I could even imagine ever accomplishing or being near or anything, because my family wasn't horsey, and, you know, there was just nothing about it that I thought would ever reach me or I could reach it. So it was kind of a big drill to have it happen, I'll tell you that.
Mike Penna, Jufeld, Clark Nyberg in studio talking with Barkley Tagg here on Trainer Talk presented by Bullet Train. Clark?
Barkley, this is Clark Nyberg. You mentioned that you were an assistant for Frank Whiteley. Tell us a little bit about that and your experience with Ruffian, because I know you were an assistant while she was in his barn.
Well, I used to gallop her a lot in the wintertime. There was another kid there, a local boy. They called him Squeaky. He was about my size, so Frank thought we were both two-way big, but we could both ride pretty well, probably better than the rest of the riders there. So he had to use us a lot. Anyway, we both rode her quite a bit the winter of her two-year-old year.
What was that like, being on her back?
Well, we called her Sophie because she was a big, fat old thing and looked like, you know, we never expected anything of it. I think Frank had her in his eye, but we never thought a whole lot of her. She just did things very easily, though. I mean, you could tell that nothing bothered her. If you went out and galloped a bunch of horses, like on a frozen cold day, we'd go out to the polo grounds and gallop them in big figure eights, and they would all get tired doing that, and she would never get tired. She'd just keep galloping along, and she was she had a heart and lungs and things like that that were just incredible. But still, Frank never let on much about her or anything else. I remember we held her for the blacksmith when he put her shoes on for the first race at Belmont, and she won by 15 lengths. And, you know, everything about her is all in writing, so there's not much sense in me elaborating on it. But
I think it's an amazing story.
She was something else. She was something else. She never had hind shoes on to the first day she ran. And I remember old Elmer Campbell came in, and he put two new front ones on her and two new hind ones on her, and away we went. And she won that race at track record time.
So, amazing
kept
story.
Right on doing it.
It's been quite a ride for her.
Yeah, she was something else, I'll tell you.
Been quite a ride for Barkley Tagg. He's done a little bit of everything here in the game, so to speak, and experienced the highs and the lows, no doubt. Barkley, back to the funny side thing here for just a minute, because you mentioned Jack Knowlton and, of course, Saratoga Stable. And what was your reaction when they said, hey, we're going to take a school bus down to the Kentucky Derby?
You know, Robin and I were concentrating on that horse so much that everything else annoyed us, to tell you the truth. It annoyed me anyway. And these guys are having such a great time, and I felt like a killjoy. I really did. But, you know, there was so much press crawling all over us all the time, and he was a high-strung horse. He was a very high-strung horse. And then, you know, we had to ship from New York to Kentucky for the Derby, and we had to ship from New York then back to New York, and then we had to ship down to Pimlico for the Preakness, and all that stuff is really telling on a horse. And, you know, after we won the Derby, we kind of certainly had the Triple Crown in mind, because the Derby winner is the only guy who can have it in mind. You know, we wanted to have him quiet as he could, and we took him home to New York, and we just, you know, kind of tried to keep the press away from him as much as we could, because everybody was into it then about, you know, here's a horse that has a chance of winning the Triple Crown. So there'd be 50, 80, 100 guys going out with him every morning. So I used to tell him I was going out at 8, take him out at 6, and switch that around now and then and stuff like that, just so I could keep him as quiet as possible. Well, I think all those newspaper guys got to hating me after a while. I don't blame them either. I was pretty miserable. But I was just, you know, mindset on getting this horse where I wanted to get him.
Yeah, I was kind of concerned about your health, actually, because you would be so intense, you know, watching the horse. And I know how the press can be relentless in their pursuit of useless information. And you would get this look on your face. And I remember telling my girlfriend, who's now my wife, you know, I'm concerned about Barkley Tagg because these guys are driving him nuts. And
yeah, they were too.
It was a relentless situation. And I have to admit, I was such a big fan of Funnyside. I actually went to the Belmont because I was, you know, hoping he'd win the Triple Crown. And in those days, I wasn't doing the races on the radio, and I wouldn't travel for that. I'd usually just watch it on TV, but I couldn't miss that. I just thought, you know, this horse really has the potential to do it. And it's too bad that he didn't, but what a great run. I mean, the whole thing was sensational.
And those guys were a lot of fun too. They were really a lot of fun, but I wasn't, to tell you, I wasn't having fun. I was just, you know, I mean, I was happy and proud that things were going right, but I wasn't having fun. I was just concentrating on that and trying to think of ways to sneak him around here and sneak him around there and stuff like that, you know. And then when after we won the Preakness, we had to go back to New York. I wish I could have hidden him somewhere for the next 3 weeks. But then I had this huge mob going to it with him all the time, you know, all over the barn all the time. And everywhere you went, and every time I took him out of the stall, and you know, it's just, and I thought, God, he's going to be a wreck by the time. That it didn't do him any good either. It made it awfully hard on him, and I think that probably hurt him in the Belmont a little bit too. I don't think he was quite the horse in that race as he'd been in the other two, but you know, they got to be able to do all that stuff to be a Triple Crown horse. So that's the way it is.
Barkley, what was that feeling after the Belmont Stakes? Was it relief because of everything that had transpired over the months before and the weeks before, or was it disappointment? I'm sure. What was that feeling?
Well, the most horrible thing about it was when the race was over, I'd walked down there and I'd walked across that where they walked the winner in, you know, and the crowd started to boo. And I felt so bad. I thought, oh, God, they're booing this horse and they're booing me. And I just, I felt like my guts were falling out of me. I just felt like my whole world was collapsing. And they were actually booing Jerry Bailey and the horse that won, the Empire Maker. That wasn't good either. But they were booing him and booing him. And I wanted to crawl in a hole.
That brings out the best and the worst in people, you know, when Birdstone won it, you know, Mrs. Whitney apologized for winning.
I know. Well, she's a pretty gracious lady.
She is.
She's a lovely gal.
Barkley Tagg, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Bullet Train. Barkley, what do you remember? Talk about going back down the road to the Kentucky Derby in 07 when you showed up with No Biz Like Showbiz. How much different was it that year?
Well, I had a little better handle on things. You know, he was a nice big horse and all that. I wasn't quite as confident in him as I was of Funnyside, but he was, you know, he'd done everything he was supposed to do. He won the Wood Memorial and Funny hadn't, and he came into the race very, very well. I was very disappointed at the head of the lane. I thought he was going to take over and go on and win the race from there, and then he just stalled out at the head of the lane. But I don't think he liked the track. The jock said he didn't care for the track, and it was just obvious that he didn't. And it is a funny track. I'm not knocking the track. It's a wonderful traditional old track, but some horses like it and some horses don't, period.
Yep.
I'm not sure whether it's wise to get down there a couple of weeks ahead of time and train over it. Sometimes that doesn't work out right either, because I kind of know this, that Pimlico and Churchill really scrape their tracks down for the Derby and the Preakness. They'll deny that to their death, but I know they do it because I've sat out right out there at night at Pimlico and watched them take truckload after truckload after truckload on Friday night before the Preakness off the track and dump it in the parking lot. So I can't see any sense in training over a track that's going to be 2 inches thinner on race day. And funny side, I took him down at the last minute, and I did with Snowbiz too. And it might have been the wrong thing to do with Snowbiz because he might have been one that really needed to train over it anyway. I don't know. I never will know. But I thought he was capable of winning the race, but, you know, he got to the head of the lane, and he finished 10th out of 20, which isn't terrible, I guess, but still it doesn't get you any accolades for the Kentucky Derby. So.
But, you know, Barkley, the one theme that I keep hearing as you discuss your horses and really what comes through as we're listening to you is that love that you have for the horses that are in your care. And I know that's always been paramount for you, is doing what's right by the horse. Talk about your philosophy in training horses and treating horses the right way.
Well, we're big on prevention. We take a lot of care of them. I'm not bragging about it particularly. I'm probably a little bit too fanatical about it. But we take a lot of care of them. And I was just looking here at some back stuff. And, you know, we had a horse called Miss Josh. She won my first grade one for those lovely people I still train for. They're wonderful, wonderful people. I'm really lucky. I've had some bad people to train for, but I've had some lovely people too, and just were a pleasure to work for. And I'm really, really lucky to have such nice people. And I still have some very, very nice people that they seem to care about Robin and I as much as they care about their horses, you know, so it's really nice. But, you know, Miss Josh won 8 stakes, and she had very bad feet and kind of beat up old legs, and she had terrible ankles, which we never operated on. I never operated on them, but I iced her and iced her and iced her, and she lasted several years at top level. And like I say, she won our first grade one, and she won 7 other stakes after that, you know, or during that time. Funny Side won 9 stakes, and we did nothing but care for him day and night. I had another horse that I bought rather cheap for $10,000 or something, Social Retiree. He won 6 stakes, and they all won more races than that, but, I mean, they were the stake races. Grab the Green won 6 stakes, Showing Up won 5, No Biz won 6, Tail of the Caddy won 4. He was a very good horse. But all horses have their ailments, just like a football team. You know, they've got a big trainer's room there with 45, 50 guys sitting in there every day in whirlpools and ice pools and getting rub downs and everything like that. And we kind of treat the racehorses the same way. And most guys do. Most guys are conscientious and work on their horses pretty hard. But we might be a little fanatical about it, but I think we keep them going and we get the best out of them. So.
Well, Barkley, believe it or not, this half an hour visit has flown by. We're at the end of the interview. We only have a couple of minutes left in the show. Want to say a very special thank you to you for taking the time. You do a tremendous job. You're a class act. You can go to Barkley Tag Racing to learn more about Barkley Tag and his operation. Barkley, we really appreciate it. Thank you very much for being our guest tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right.
Have
thanks
a nice
so much.
Evening.
We'll see you in Florida.
Great job.
All right, Barkley Tag. Wow, some great stories there. Just amazing stuff. And Barkley actually has a quote on his website, which I love. And Jude, you'll appreciate this. 1,000,000 things have to go right to win a race. Only one thing has to go wrong to lose it.
No question about it.
How true is that?
Couldn't say it any better. That is absolutely spot on. And, you know, you can tell he embraces the passion of the game, and he has a good outlook. I mean, he can laugh now when things go bad. don't bother him during the Derby. Honestly, I remember the look on his face.
Intense.
And I remember, you know, talking to Gretchen about it. I said, this guy, he might have a stroke or something. He was so intense. And it's tremendous pressure. I mean, I don't think people realize it.
Well, when you're going for the Triple Crown, yeah, that pressure is just – and he was thrown in the deep end. I mean, this was something he had never experienced before.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you know, he'd put his butt on the line for this too, because, you know, of course, after you win the Derby, the owner's a little bit more forgiving, but there's guys that have won the Derby that have gotten fired too, yeah. like Eddie Gregson. But, you know, it's a tough racket.
And, Billy Turner.
And, yeah. You just really have to take it with a grain of salt, and I think now he looks at a little bit of the bigger picture.
Well, if you missed any portion of this Trainer Talk show tonight, outstanding visits with Jimmy Jerkins and with Barkley Tag. We want to thank both of those guests for coming on the show. You can catch a podcast tomorrow on our website. It will be up there by tomorrow morning, Horse Racing Radio. trainertalk.net. All of our Trainer Talk shows are podcast there. We're back tomorrow, 3 to 7 Eastern Time, the Final Furlong Show tomorrow night, 6 to 7. That is our listener call-in. Get ready to call in, talk some Derby with us. I know it's going to be a hot topic tomorrow night. We'll take a look at those prep races from last weekend as well. You can do that tomorrow night, 6 to 7 Eastern. We're back with Gulfstream, Aqueduct, Santa Anita, and Oaklawn, all starting 3 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow. Visit horseracingradio.net for more information. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, Ponte for the Pick 4, Clark Nyberg, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.